Side 3. Christine. Continuing on page 81. That place bites the root anyway. Will Darnell's an asshole. I guess it would be stupid to try and keep it there anymore anyway, he said. Even if Darnell lets me come back, Repperton's there. I'd fight him again. I started to hum the theme from Rocky. Yeah, fuck you and the cayuse you rode in on, Range Rider, he said, smiling a little. I really would fight him. But Repperton might take after her with that jackhandle again when I wasn't there. I don't think Darnell would stop him if he did. I didn't answer, and maybe Arnie thought that meant I agreed with him, but I didn't. I didn't think his old rust bucket Plymouth Fury was the main target. And if Repperton felt that he couldn't accomplish the demolition of the main target by himself, he would simply get by with a little help from his friends, Don Vandenberg, Moochie Welch, et al. Get on your motor huckle boots, boys. We got plenty good stomping tonight. It occurred to me that they could kill him. Not just kill him, but really, honest to Christ, kill him. Guys like that sometimes did. Things just went a little too far, and some kid wound up dead. You read about it in the paper sometimes. Keeper? Huh? I hadn't followed that. Up ahead, Arnie's house was in view. I asked if you had any ideas about where I could keep her. The car, the car, the car, that's all he could talk about. He was starting to sound like a broken record. And worse, it was always her, her, her. He was bright enough to see his growing obsession with her. It, damn it, it. But he wasn't picking it up. He wasn't picking it up at all. Arnie, I said, my man, you've got more important things to worry about than where to keep the car. I want to know where you're going to keep you. Huh? What are you talking about? I'm asking you what you're going to do if Buddy and Buddy's buddies decide they want to put you in traction. His face suddenly grew wise. It grew wise so suddenly that it was frightening to watch. It was wise and helpless and enduring. It was a face I recognized from the news when I was only 8 or 9 or so. The face of all those soldiers in black pajamas who had kicked the living shit out of the best-equipped and best-supported army in the world. Dennis, he said, I'll do what I can. 10. Libé passes. I got no car, and it's breaking my heart. But I got a driver, and that's a start. Lennon and McCartney. The movie version of Grease had just opened, and I took the cheerleader out to see it that night. I thought it was dumb. The cheerleader loved it. I sat there watching these totally unreal teenagers dance and sing. If I want realistic teenagers, well, more or less, I'll catch the Blackboard Jungle sometime on a revival. And my mind just drifted away, and suddenly I had a brainstorm, the way you sometimes will when you're not thinking about anything in particular. I excused myself and went into the lobby to use the payphone. I called Arnie's house, dialing quick and sure. I'd had his number memorized since I was 8 or so. It could have waited until the movie was over, but it just seemed like such a damn good idea. Arnie himself answered. Hello? Arnie, it's Dennis. Oh, Dennis. His voice was so odd and flat that I got a little scared. Arnie, are you all right? Huh? Sure. I thought you were taking Roseanne to the movies. That's where I'm calling from. It must not be that exciting, Arnie said. His voice was still flat, flat and dreary. Roseanne thinks it's great. I thought that would get a laugh out of him, but there was only a patient, waiting silence. Listen, I said. I thought of the answer. Answer? Sure, I said. Libé, Libé is the answer. Libé, he said in a strange high voice. And then there was more silence. I was starting to get more than a little scared. I'd never known him to be quite this way. Sure, I babbled. Libé, Libé's got a garage, and I got the idea that he'd eat a dead rat sandwich if the profit margin looked high enough. If you were to approach him on the basis of 16 or 17 bucks a week. Very funny, Dennis. His voice was cold and hateful. Arnie, what? He hung up. I stood there, looking at the phone, wondering what the hell it was about. Some new move from his parents? Or had he maybe gone back to Darnell's and found some new damage to his car? Or a sudden intuition, almost a certainty, struck me. I put the telephone back in its cradle and walked over to the concession stand and asked if they had today's paper. The candy and popcorn girl finally fished it out and then stood there snapping her gum while I thumbed to the back, where they print the obituaries. I guess she wanted to make sure I wasn't going to perform some weird perversion on it, or maybe eat it. There was nothing at all, or so I thought at first. Then I turned the page and saw the headline, Libertyville Veteran Dies at 71. There was a picture of Roland D. LeBay in his army uniform, looking 20 years younger and considerably more bright-eyed than he had on the occasions Arnie and I had seen him. The obit was brief. LeBay had died suddenly on Saturday afternoon. He was survived by a brother, George, and a sister, Marcia. Funeral services were scheduled for Tuesday at 2. Suddenly. In the obits, it's always after a long illness, after a short illness, or suddenly. Suddenly can mean anything from a brain embolism to electrocuting yourself in the bathtub. I remembered something I had done to Ellie when she was hardly more than a baby, 3 maybe. I scared the bejesus out of her with a jack-in-the-box. There was the little handle going around in Big Brother Dennis's hand, making music. Not bad, kind of fun. And then kabunzo! Out comes this guy with a grinning face and an ugly hooked nose, almost hitting her in the eye. Ellie went off bawling to find her mother, and I sat there looking glumly at Jack as he nodded back and forth, knowing I was probably going to get hollered at, knowing that I probably deserved to get hollered at. I had known it was going to scare her coming out of the music like that all at once with an ugly bang. Coming out so suddenly. I gave the paper back and stood there, looking blankly at the posters advertising Next Attraction and Coming Soon. Saturday afternoon. Suddenly. Funny how things sometimes worked out. My brainstorm had been that maybe Arnie could take Christine back where she had come from. Maybe he could pay LeBay for space. Now it turned out that LeBay was dead. He had died, as a matter of fact, on the same day that Arnie had gotten into it with Buddy Rapperton, the same day Buddy had smashed Christine's headlight. All at once I had an irrational picture of Buddy Rapperton swinging that jackhandle, and at the exact same moment, LeBay's eye gushes blood, he keels over, and suddenly, very suddenly, "Cut the shit, Dennis," I lectured, "just cut the..." And then, somewhere deep in my mind, somewhere near the center, a voice whispered, "Come on, big guy, let's cruise," and then fell still. The girl behind the counter popped her gum and said, "You're missing the end of the picture. Ending's the best part." "Yeah, thanks." I started back toward the door of the theater and then detoured to the drinking fountain. My throat was very dry. Before I'd finished getting my drink, the doors opened and people came streaming out. Beyond and above their bobbing heads, I could see the credit roll. Then Roseanne came out, looking around for me. She caught many appreciative glances and fielded them cleanly in that dreamy, composed way of hers. "Den-Den," she said, taking my arm. "Being called Den-Den isn't the worst thing in the world. Having your eyes put out with a hot poker, or having a leg amputated with a chainsaw, is probably worse. But I've never really dug it all that much." "Where were you? You missed the ending." "Ending's the best part," I finished with her. "Sorry, I just had this call of nature. It came on very suddenly." "I'll tell you all about it if you take me up to the embankment for a while," she said, pressing my arm against the soft side swell of her breast. "If you want to talk, that is." "Did it have a happy ending?" She smiled up at me, her eyes wide and sweet and a little dazed as they always were. She held my arm even more tightly against her breast. "Very happy," she said. "I like happy endings, don't you, Den-Den?" "Love them," I said. I should maybe have been thinking about the promise of her breast, but instead I found myself thinking about Arnie. That night I had a dream again, only in this one, Christine was old. No, not just old, she was ancient, a terrible hulk of a car, something you'd expect to see in a tarot deck. Instead of the hanged man, the death car, something you could almost believe was as old as the pyramids. The engine roared and missed and jetted filthy blue oil smoke. It wasn't empty. Roland D. LeBay was lolling behind the wheel. His eyes were open, but they were glazed and dead. Each time the engine revved and Christine's rust-eaten body vibrated, he flopped like a rag doll. His peeling skull nodded back and forth. Then the tires screamed their terrible scream, the Plymouth lunged out of the garage at me, and as it did, the rust melted away, the old bleary glass clarified, the chrome winked with savage newness, and the old balding tire suddenly bloomed into plump new wide ovals, each tread seemingly as deep as the Grand Canyon. It screamed at me, headlights glaring white circles of hate, and as I raised my hands in a stupid, useless warding-off gesture, I thought, God, it's unending fury! I woke up. I didn't scream. That night I kept the scream in my throat. Just barely. I sat up in my bed, a cold puddle of moonlight caught in a lap full of sheet, and I thought, died suddenly. That night I didn't get back to sleep so quickly. 11. The funeral. Eldorado fins, white walls, and skirts. Rides just like a little bit of heaven here on earth. Well, buddy, when I die, throw my body in the back and drive me to the junkyard in my Cadillac. Bruce Springsteen. Brad Jeffries, our road crew foreman, was in his mid-40s, balding, stocky, permanently sunburned. He liked to holler a lot, particularly when we were behind schedule. But he was a decent enough man. I went to see him during our coffee break to find out if Arnie had asked for part or all of the afternoon off. He asked for 2 hours so we could go to a burying, Brad said. He took off his steel-rimmed glasses and massaged the red spots they had left on the sides of his nose. Now don't you ask. I'm losing you both at the end of the week anyway, and all the jerk-offs are staying. Brad, I have to ask. Why, who is this guy? Cunningham said he sold him a car, that's all. Christ, I didn't think anyone went to a used car salesman's funeral except for his family. It wasn't a used car salesman, it was just a guy. Arnie's having some problems about this, Brad. I feel like I ought to go with him. Brad sighed. Okay. You can have 1 to 3, just like him. If you'll agree to work through your lunch hour and stay on till 6 Thursday night. Sure, thanks, Brad. I'll punch you out just like regular, Brad said. And if anybody at Penn DOT in Pittsburgh finds out about this, my ass is going to be grass. They won't. Gonna be sorry to lose you guys, he said. He picked up the paper and shook it out to the sports. Coming from Brad, that was high praise. It's been a good summer for us, too. I'm glad you feel that way, Dennis. Now get out of here and let me read the paper. I did. At 1 o'clock, I caught a ride up to the main construction shed on a grader. Arnie was inside, hanging up his yellow hard hat and putting on a clean shirt. He looked at me, startled. Dennis, what are you doing here? Getting ready to go to a funeral, I said, same as you. No, he said immediately. And it was more that word than anything else. The Saturdays he was no longer there. The coolness of Michael and Regina over the phone. The way he had been when I called him from the movies. That made me realize how much he had shut me out of his life, and how it had happened in just the same way LeBay had died, suddenly. Yes, I said. Arnie, I dream about the guy. You hear me talking to you? I dream about him. I'm going. We can go separately or together, but I'm going. You weren't joking, were you? Huh? When you called me on the phone from that theater, you really didn't know he was dead. Jesus Christ, you think I'd joke about something like that? No, he said, but not right away. He didn't say no until he'd thought it over carefully. He saw the possibility of all hands being turned against him now. Will Darnell had done that to him, and Buddy Repperton, and I suppose his mother and father, too. But it wasn't just them, or even principally them, because none of them was the first cause. It was the car. You dream about him? Yes. He stood there with his clean shirt in his hands, musing over that. The paper said Libertyville Heights Cemetery, I said finally. You going to take the bus or ride with me? I'll ride with you. Good deal. We stood on a hill above the graveside service, neither daring nor wanting to go down and join the handful of mourners. There were less than a dozen of them, all told, half of them old guys in uniforms that looked old and carefully preserved. You could almost smell the mothballs. LeBay's casket was on runners over the grave. There was a flag on it. The preacher's words drifted up to us on a hot, late August breeze. Man is like the grass which grows and then is cut down. Man is like a flower which blooms in the spring and fades in the summer. Man is in love and loves what passes. When the service ended, the flag was removed, and a man who looked to be in his 60s threw a handful of earth onto the coffin. Little particles trickled off and fell into the hole beneath. The obit had said he was survived by a brother and a sister. This had to be the brother. The resemblance wasn't overwhelming, but it was there. The sister evidently hadn't made it. There was no one but the boys down there around that hole in the ground. Two of the American Legion types folded the flag into a cocked hat, and one of them handed it to LeBay's brother. The preacher asked the Lord to bless them and keep them, to make his face shine upon them, to lift them up and give them peace. They started to drift away. I looked around for Arnie, and Arnie wasn't beside me anymore. He had gone a little distance away. He was standing under a tree. There were tears on his cheeks. "You okay, Arnie?" I asked. It occurred to me that I sure as hell hadn't seen any tears down there. And if Roland D. LeBay had known that Arnie Cunningham was going to be the only person to shed a tear for him at his small-time graveside ceremonies in one of western Pennsylvania's lesser-known boneyards, he might have knocked $50 off the price of his shitty car. After all, Arnie still would have been paying $150 more than it was worth. He skidded the heels of his hands up the sides of his face in a gesture that was nearly savage. "Fine," he said hoarsely. "Come on." "Sure." I thought he meant it was time to go. But he didn't start back toward where I'd parked my duster. He started down the hill instead. I started to ask him where he was going and then shut my mouth. I knew well enough he wanted to talk to LeBay's brother. The brother was standing with two of the Legionnaire types, talking quietly, the flag under his arm. He was dressed in the suit of a man who was approaching retirement on a questionable income. It was a blue pinstripe with a slightly shiny seat. His tie was wrinkled at the bottom, and his white shirt had a yellowish tinge at the collar. He glanced around at us. "Pardon me," Arnie said, "but you're Mr. LeBay's brother, aren't you?" "Yes, I am." He looked at Arnie questioningly, and I thought a little warily. Arnie put out his hand. "My name is Arnold Cunningham. I knew your brother slightly. I bought a car from him a short while ago." When Arnie put his hand out, LeBay had automatically reached for it. With American men, the only gesture which may be more ingrained than the handshake response is checking your fly to make sure it's zipped after you come out of a public restroom. But when Arnie went on to say he had bought a car from LeBay, the hand hesitated on its course. For a moment, I thought the man was not going to shake after all, that he would pull back and just leave Arnie's hand floating out there in the ozone. But he didn't do that, at least not quite. He gave Arnie's hand a single token squeeze and then dropped it. "Christine," he said in a dry voice. Yes, the family resemblance was there, in the way the brow shelved over the eyes, the set of the jaw, the light blue eyes. But this man's face was softer, almost kind. I did not think he was ever going to have the lean and vulpine aspect that had been Roland D. LeBay's. "The last note I got from Raleigh said he'd sold her." Good Christ, he was using that damned female pronoun, too. And Raleigh. It was hard to imagine LeBay, with his peeling skull and his pestiferous back brace, as anyone's Raleigh. But his brother had spoken the nickname in that same dry voice. There was no love in that voice, at least none that I could hear. LeBay went on. "My brother didn't ride often, but he had a tendency to gloat, Mr. Cunningham. I wish there was a gentler word for it, but I don't believe there is. In his note, Raleigh spoke of you as a sucker and said he had given you what he called a royal screwing." My mouth dropped open. I turned to Arnie, half expecting another outburst of rage. But his face hadn't changed at all. "A royal screwing," he said mildly, "is always in the eye of the beholder. Don't you think so, Mr. LeBay?" LeBay laughed, a little reluctantly, I thought. "This is my friend. He was with me the day I bought the car." I was introduced and shook George LeBay's hand. The soldiers had drifted away. The three of us, LeBay, Arnie, and I, were left eyeing one another uncomfortably. LeBay shifted his brother's flag from one hand to the other. "Can I do something for you, Mr. Cunningham?" LeBay asked at last. Arnie cleared his throat. "I was wondering about the garage," he said finally. "You see, I'm working on the car, trying to get her street legal again. My folks don't want it at my house, and I was wondering... No. If maybe I could rent the garage... No, out of the question, it's really... I'd pay you $20 a week, Arnie said. $25 if you wanted. I winced. He was like a kid who has stumbled into quicksand and decides to cheer himself up by eating a few arsenic-laced brownies. Impossible. LeBay was looking more and more distressed. Just the garage, Arnie said, his calm starting to crack. Just the garage where it originally was. It can't be done, LeBay said. I listed the house with Century 21, Libertyville Realty, and Pittsburgh Homes just this morning. They'll be showing the house. Yes, yeah, sure, in time, but until... And it wouldn't do to have you tinkering around. You see, don't you? He bent toward Arnie a little. Please don't misunderstand me. I have nothing against teenagers in general. If I did, I'd probably be in a lunatic asylum now because I've taught high school in Paradise Falls, Ohio for almost 40 years, and you seem to be a very intelligent, well-spoken example of the genus adolescent, but all I want to do here in Libertyville is sell the house and split whatever proceeds there may be with my sister in Denver. I want to be shut of the house, Mr. Cunningham, and I want to be shut of my brother's life.
I see, Arnie said. Would it make any difference if I promised to look after the place? Mow the grass, repaint the trim, make little repairs? I can be handy that way.
He really is good at stuff like that, I chipped in. It wouldn't hurt, I thought, for Arnie to remember later that I had been on his side, even if I wasn't. I've already hired a fellow to keep an eye on the place and do a little maintenance, he said. It sounded plausible, but I knew, suddenly and surely, that it was a lie. And I think Arnie knew it, too.
All right. I'm sorry about your brother. He seemed like a very strong-willed man.
As he said it, I found myself remembering turning around and seeing LeBay with large, greasy tears on his cheeks.
Well, that's that. I'm shot of her, sonny.
Strong-willed? LeBay smiled cynically.
Oh, yes. He was a strong-willed son of a bitch.
He appeared not to notice Arnie's shocked expression. Excuse me, gentlemen. I'm afraid the sun has upset my stomach a little. He started to walk away. We stood not far from the grave and watched him go. All at once he stopped, and Arnie's face brightened. He thought LeBay had suddenly changed his mind. For a moment, LeBay just stood there on the grass, his head bent in the posture of a man thinking hard. Then he turned back to us.
My advice to you is to forget the car, he said to Arnie. Sell her. If no one will buy her whole, sell her for parts. If no one will buy her for parts, junk her. Do it quickly and completely. Do it the way you would quit a bad habit. I think you will be happier.
He stood there, looking at Arnie, waiting for Arnie to say something, but Arnie made no reply. He only held LeBay's gaze with his own. His eyes had gone that peculiar slaty color they got when his mind was made up and his feet were planted. LeBay read the look and nodded. He looked unhappy and a little ill.
Gentlemen, good day.
Arnie sighed.
I guess that's that.
He eyed LeBay's retreating back with some resentment.
Yeah, I said, hoping I sounded more unhappy than I felt. It was the dream. I didn't like the idea of Christine back in that garage. It was too much like my dream.
We started back toward my car, neither of us speaking. LeBay nagged at me. Both LeBays nagged at me. I came to a sudden, impulsive decision. God only knows how much different things might have been if I hadn't followed the impulse.
Hey, man, I said, I gotta take a whiz. Give me a minute or two, okay?
Sure, he said, hardly looking up. He walked on, hands in his pockets and eyes on the ground. I walked off to the left where a small, discreet sign and an even smaller arrow pointed the way toward the restrooms. But when I was over the first rise and out of Arnie's view, I cut to the right and started to sprint toward the parking lot. I caught George LeBay slowly folding himself behind the wheel of an extremely tiny Chevette with a Hertz sticker on the windshield.
Mr. LeBay, I puffed. Mr. LeBay?
He looked up curiously.
Pardon me, I said. Sorry to bother you again.
That's all right, he said. But I'm afraid what I said to your friend still stands. I can't let him garage the car there.
Good, I said. His bushy eyebrows went up. The car, I said, that Fury, I don't like it.
He went on looking at me, not talking. I don't think it's been good for him. Maybe part of it's being, I don't know,
jealous, he asked me quietly.
Time he used to spend with you, he now spends with her?
Well, yeah, right, I said. He's been my friend for a long time, but I don't think that's all of it.
No?
No.
I looked around to see if Arnie was in sight, and while I wasn't looking at him, I was finally able to come out with it.
Why did you tell him to junk it and forget it? Why did you say it was like a bad habit?
He said nothing, and I was afraid he had nothing to say, at least not to me. And then, almost too softly to hear, he asked,
Son, are you sure this is your business?
I don't know. Suddenly it seemed very important to meet his eyes. But I care about Arnie, you know. I don't want to see him get hurt. This car has already gotten him in trouble. I don't want to see it get any worse.
Come by my motel this evening. It's just off the Western Avenue exit from 376. Can you find that?
I hot-patched the sides of the ramp, I said, and held out my hands. Still got the blisters.
I smiled, but he didn't smile back. Rainbow Motel. There are two at the foot of that exit. Mine is the cheap one.
Thanks, I said awkwardly.
Listen, really, it may not be your business or mine or anyone's, LeBay said in his soft, schoolteacherish voice. So different from, but somehow so eerily similar to, his late brother's wild croak.
And that's about the finest smell in the world, except maybe for pussy.
But I can tell you this much right now. My brother was not a good man. I believe the only thing he ever truly loved in his whole life was that Plymouth Fury your friend has purchased. So the business may be between them and them alone. No matter what you tell me or I tell you.
He smiled at me. It wasn't a pleasant smile.
And in that instant, I seemed to see Roland D. LeBay looking out through his eyes, and I shivered.
Son, you're probably too young to look for wisdom in anyone's words but your own. But I'll tell you this. Love is the enemy.
He nodded at me slowly.
Yes, the poets continually and sometimes willfully mistake love. Love is the old slaughterer. Love is not blind. Love is a cannibal with extremely acute vision. Love is insectile. It is always hungry.
What does it eat? I asked, not aware I was going to ask anything at all. Every part of me but my mouth thought the entire conversation insane.
Friendship, George LeBay said. It eats friendship. If I were you, Dennis, I would now prepare for the worst.
He closed the door of the Chevette with a soft chuck and started up its sewing machine engine. He drove away, leaving me to stand there on the edge of the blacktop. I suddenly remembered that Arnie should see me coming from the direction of the comfort stations, so I headed that way as fast as I could. As I went, it occurred to me that the grave diggers or sextons or eternal engineers or whatever they were calling themselves these days would now be lowering LeBay's coffin into the earth. The dirt George LeBay had thrown at the end of the ceremony would be splattered across the top like a conquering hand. I tried to dismiss the image, but another image, even worse, came in its place. Roland D. LeBay inside the silk-lined casket, dressed in his best suit, and his best underwear, sans smelly yellowing back brace, of course. LeBay was in the ground. LeBay was in his coffin, his hands crossed on his chest. And why was I so sure that a large, shit-eating grin was on his face?
12. Some family history. Can't you hear it out of Needham, Route 128, down to the power lines? It's so cold here in the dark, it's so exciting in the dark.
Jonathan Richmond and the Modern Lovers. The Rainbow Motel was pretty bad, all right. It was one level high. The parking lot paving was cracked. Two of the letters in the neon sign were out. It was exactly the sort of place you'd expect to find an elderly English teacher. I know how depressing that sounds, but it's true. And tomorrow he would turn in his Hertz car at the airport and fly home to Paradise Falls, Ohio. The Rainbow Motel looked like a geriatric ward. There were old parties sitting outside their rooms in the lawn chairs the management supplied for that purpose, their bony knees crossed, their white socks pulled up over their hairy shins. The men all looked like aging alpinists, skinny and tough. Most of the women were blooming with the soft fat of post-50 and no hope. Since then, I've noticed that there are motels which seem filled up with nothing but people over 50. It's like they hear about these places on some oldies-but-goodies hotline. Bring your hysterectomy and enlarged prostate to the not-so-scenic Rainbow Motel. No cable TV, but we do have magic fingers, just a quarter a shot. I saw no young people outside the units. And off to one side, the rusty playground equipment stood empty, the swings casting long, still shadows on the ground. Overhead, a neon rainbow arced over the sign. It buzzed like a swarm of flies caught in a bottle. LeBay was sitting outside Unit 14 with a glass in his hand. I went over and shook hands with him. "Would you like a soft drink?" he asked. "There's a machine in the office that dispenses them." "No, thanks," I said. I got one of the lawn chairs from in front of an empty unit and sat down beside him. "Then let me tell you what I can," he said in his soft, cultured voice. "I am 11 years younger than Raleigh, and I am still a man who is learning to be old." I shifted awkwardly in my chair and said nothing. "There were 4 of us," he said. "Raleigh was the oldest, I the youngest. Our brother Drew died in France in 1944. He and Raleigh were both career army. We grew up here in Libertyville. Only Libertyville was much, much smaller then, you know, only a village. Small enough to have the ins and the outs. We were the outs. Poor folks, shiftless, wrong side of the tracks. Pick your cliché." He chuckled softly in the dusk and poured more 7-Up into his glass. "I really remember only one constant thing about Raleigh's childhood. After all, he was in the 5th grade when I was born. But I remember that one thing very well." "What was it?" "His anger," LeBay said. "Raleigh was always angry. He was angry that he had to go to school in cast-off clothes. He was angry that our father was a drunkard who could not hold a steady job in any of the steel mills. He was angry that our mother could not make our father stop drinking. He was angry at the 3 smaller children, Drew, Marcia, and myself, who made the poverty insurmountable." He held his arm out to me and pushed up the sleeve of his shirt to show me the withered, corded tendons of his old man's arm, which lay just below the surface of the shiny, stretched skin. A scar skidded down from his elbow toward his wrist, where it finally petered out. "And that was a present from Raleigh," he said. "I got it when I was 3, and he was 14. I was playing with a few painted blocks of wood that were supposed to be cars and trucks on the front walk, when he slammed out on his way to school. I was in his way, I suppose. He pushed me, went onto the sidewalk, and then he came back and threw me. I landed with my arm stuck on one of the pickets of the fence that went around the bunch of weeds and sunflowers that my mother insisted on calling the garden. I bled enough to scare all of them into tears. All of them except Raleigh, who just kept shouting, 'You stay out of my way from now on, you goddamn snot-nose. Stay out of my way, you hear?'" I looked at the old scar, fascinated, realizing that it looked like a skid, because that small, chubby 3-year-old's arm had grown over the course of years into the skinny, shiny old man's arm I was now looking at. A wound that had been an ugly gouge spilling blood everywhere in the year 1921 had slowly elongated into this silvery progression of marks like ladder rungs. The wound had closed, but the scar had spread. A terrible, hopeless shudder twisted through me. I thought of Arnie slamming his fists down on the dashboard of my car. Arnie crying hoarsely that he would make them eat it, eat it, eat it. George LeBay was looking at me. I don't know what he saw on my face, but he slowly rolled his sleeve back down. And when he buttoned it securely over that scar, it was as if he had drawn the curtain on an almost unbearable past. He sipped more 7-Up. My father came home that evening. He had been on one of the toots that he called hunting up a job. And when he heard what Raleigh had done, he whaled the tar out of him. But Raleigh would not recant. He cried, but he would not recant. LeBay smiled a little. At the end, my mother was terrified, screaming for my father to stop before he killed him. The tears were rolling down Raleigh's face, and still he would not recant. He was in my way, Raleigh said, through his tears. And if he gets in my way again, I'll do it again. And you can't stop me, you damned old tosspot. Then my father struck him in the face and made his nose bleed, and Raleigh fell on the floor with the blood squirting through his fingers. My mother was screaming, Marcia was crying, Drew was cringing in one corner, and I was bawling my head off, holding my bandaged arm. And Raleigh went right on saying, I'd do it again, you tosspot, damned old tosspot. Above us, the stars had begun to come out. An old woman left a unit down the way, took a battered suitcase out of a Ford, and carried it back into her unit. Somewhere a radio was playing. It was not tuned to the rock sounds of FM 104. His unending fury is what I remember best, LeBay repeated softly. At school, he fought with anyone who made fun of his clothes or the way his hair was cut. He would fight anyone he even suspected of making fun. He was suspended again and again. Finally, he left and joined the army. It wasn't a good time to be in the army, the '20s. There was no dignity, no promotion, no flying flags and banners. There was no nobility. He went from base to base, first in the south, and then in the southwest. We got a letter every 3 months or so. He was still angry. He was angry at what he called the shitters. Everything was the fault of the shitters. The shitters wouldn't give him the promotion he deserved. The shitters had canceled a furlough. The shitters couldn't find their own behinds with both hands and a flashlight. On at least two occasions, the shitters put him in the stockade. The army held on to him because he was an excellent mechanic. He could keep the old and decrepit vehicles, which were all Congress would allow the army, in some sort of running condition. Uneasily, I found myself thinking of Arnie again, Arnie who was so clever with his hands. LeBay leaned forward. But that talent was just another wellspring for his anger, young man. And it was an anger that never ended until he bought that car that your friend now owns. What do you mean? LeBay chuckled dryly. He fixed army convoy trucks, army staff cars, army weapon supply vehicles. He fixed bulldozers and kept staff cars running with spit and baling wire. And once, when a visiting congressman came to visit Fort Arnold in West Texas and had car trouble, he was ordered by his commanding officer, who was desperate to make a good impression, to fix the congressman's prized Bentley. Oh, yes, we got a 4-page letter about that particular shitter. A 4-page rant of Raleigh's anger and vitriol. It was a wonder the words didn't smoke on the page. All those vehicles. But Raleigh never owned a car himself until after World War II. Even then, the only thing he was able to afford was an old Chevrolet that ran poorly and was eaten up with rust. In the '20s and thirties, there was never money enough. And during the war years, he was too busy trying to stay alive. He was in the motor pool for all those years, and he fixed thousands of vehicles for the shitters, and never had one that was all his. It was Libertyville all over again. Even the old Chevrolet couldn't assuage that, or the old Hudson Hornet he bought used the year after he got married. Married? Didn't tell you that, did he? LeBay said. He would have been happy to go on and on about his army experiences, his war experiences, and his endless confrontations with the shitters,
for as long as you and your friend could listen without falling asleep, and him with his hand in your pocket feeling for your wallet the whole time. But he wouldn't have bothered to tell you about Veronica or Rita.
Who were they?
Veronica was his wife, LeBay said. They were married in 1951, shortly before Raleigh went to Korea. He could have stayed stateside, you know. He was married, his wife was pregnant, he himself was approaching middle age. But he chose to go.
LeBay looked reflectively at the dead playground equipment.
It was bigamy, you know. By 1951, he was 44, and he was married already. He was married to the army, and to the shitters.
He fell silent again. His silence had a morbid quality.
Are you all right? I asked finally. Yes, he said. Just thinking ill of the dead.
He looked at me calmly. Except for his eyes, they were dark and wounded.
You know, all of this hurts me, young man. What did you say your name was? I don't want to sit here and sing these old sad songs to someone I can't call by his first name. Was it Donald?
Dennis, I said.
Look, Mr. LeBay, it hurts more than I would have suspected, he went on. But now that it's begun, let's finish it, shall we? I only met Veronica twice. She was from West Virginia, near Wheeling. She was what we then called Shirttail Southern. And she was not terribly bright. Raleigh was able to dominate her and take her for granted, which was what he seemed to want. But she loved him, I think. At least until the rotten business with Rita. As for Raleigh, I don't think he really married a woman at all. He married a kind of wailing wall. The letters that he sent us, well, you must remember that he left school very early. The letters, illiterate as they were, represented a tremendous effort for my brother. They were his suspension bridge, his novel, his symphony, his great effort. I don't think he wrote them to get rid of the poison in his heart. I think he wrote them to spread it around. Once he had Veronica, the letters stopped. He had his set of eternal ears, and he didn't have to bother with us anymore. I suppose he wrote letters to her during the 2 years he was in Korea. I only got one during that period, and I believe Marcia got two. There was no pleasure over the birth of his daughter in early 1952, only a surly complaint that there was another mouth to feed at home, and the shitters took a little more out of him.
Did he never advance in rank? I asked. The year before, I had seen part of a long TV show, one of those novels for television called Once an Eagle. I had seen the paperback book in the drugstore the next day and had picked it up, hoping for a good war story. As it turned out, I got both war and peace and some new ideas about the armed services. One of them was that the old promotion train really gets rolling along in times of war. It was hard for me to understand how LeBay could have gone into the service in the early 20s, slogged through 2 wars, and still have been running junk when Ike became president. LeBay laughed.
He was like Truett in From Here to Eternity. He would advance, and then he would be busted back down for something. Insubordination, or impertinence, or drunkenness. I told you he had spent time in the stockade. One of those times was for pissing in the punch bowl at the officers' club at Fort Dix before a party. He only did 10 days for that offense because I believe they must have looked into their own hearts and believed it was nothing more than a drunken joke, such as some of the officers themselves had probably played as fraternity boys. They couldn't have any idea of the hate and deadly loathing that lay behind that gesture. But I imagine that by then Veronica could have told them. I glanced at my watch. It was 9:15. LeBay had been talking for nearly an hour. My brother came home from Korea in 1953 to meet his daughter for the first time. I understand he looked her over for a minute or two, then handed her back to his wife and went out to tinker on his old Chevrolet for the rest of the day. Getting bored, Dennis?
No, I said truthfully.
All through those years, the one thing that Raleigh really wanted was a brand new car. Not a Cadillac or a Lincoln. He didn't want to join the upper class, the officers, the shitters. He wanted a new Plymouth or maybe a Ford or a Dodge. Veronica wrote now and then, and she said that they spent most of their Sundays going around to car dealerships wherever Raleigh was currently stationed. She and the baby would sit in the old Hornet Raleigh had then, and Veronica would read little storybooks to Rita, while Raleigh walked around dusty lot after dusty lot with salesman after salesman, talking about compression and horsepower and hemi heads and gear ratios. I think sometimes of the little girl growing up to the background sound of those plastic pennants whipping in the hot wind of half a dozen army tank towns, and I don't know whether to laugh or cry. My thoughts turned back to Arnie again. Was he obsessed, would you say? Yes, I would say he was obsessed. He began to give Veronica money to put away. Other than his failure to get promoted past Master Sergeant at any point in his career, my brother had a problem with drink. He wasn't an alcoholic, but he went on periodic binges every 6 or 8 months. What money he had would be gone when the binge was over. He was never sure where he spent it. Veronica was supposed to put a stop to that. It was one of the things he married her for. When the binges started, Raleigh would come to her for the money. He threatened her with a knife once, held it to her throat. I got this from my sister, who sometimes talked to Veronica on the telephone. Veronica would not give him the money, which at that time in 1955 totaled about $800. "Remember the car, honey," she told him, with the point of his knife on her throat. "You'll never get that new car if and you booze the money away." "She must have loved him," I said. "Well, maybe she did. But please don't make the romantic assumption that her love changed Raleigh in any way. Water can wear away stone, but only over hundreds of years. People are mortal." He seemed to debate saying something else along that line, and then to decide against it. The lapse struck me as peculiar. "But he never put a mark on either of them," he said. "And you must remember that he was drunk on the occasion when he held the knife to her throat. There is a great outcry about drugs in the schools now, and I don't oppose that outcry because I think it's obscene to think of children 15 and 16 years old reeling around full of dope. But I still believe alcohol is the most vulgar, dangerous drug ever invented, and it is legal. When my brother finally left the army in 1957, Veronica had put away a little over $1,200. Adding to it was a substantial disability pension for his back injury. He fought the shitters for it and won, he said. So, the money was finally there. They got the house you and your friend visited. But before the house was even considered, of course, the car came. The car was always paramount. The visits to the car dealerships reached a fever pitch, and at last, he settled upon Christine. I got a long letter about her. She was a 1958 Fury Sport Coupe, and he gave me all the facts and figures in his letter. I don't remember them, but I bet your friend could cite her vital statistics, chapter and verse. "Her measurements," I said. LeBay smiled humorlessly. "Her measurements, yes. I do remember that he wrote her sticker price was just a tad under $3,000. But he jewed him down, as he put it, to $2,100 with the trade-in. He ordered her, paid 10% down, and when she came, he paid the balance in cash. $10 and $20 bills. The next year, Rita, who was then 6, choked to death. I jumped in my chair and almost knocked it over. His soft, teacherish voice had a lulling quality, and I was tired. I'd been half asleep. That last had been like a dash of cold water in my face. "Yes, that's right," he said to my questioning, startled glance. "They had been out motorvating for the day." That was what replaced the car hunting expeditions. Motorvating, that was his word for it. He got that from one of those rock and roll songs he was always listening to. Every Sunday, the three of them would go out motivating. There were litter bags in the front and the back. The little girl was forbidden to drop anything on the floor. She was forbidden to make any messes. She knew that lesson well. He fell into that peculiar thinking silence again, and then came back on a new tack. Raleigh kept the ashtrays clean, always. He was a heavy smoker, but he'd poke his cigarette out the wing window instead of tapping it into the ashtray. And when he was done with a cigarette, he'd snuff it and toss it out the window. If he had someone with him who did use the ashtray, he'd dump the ashtray and then wipe it out with a paper towel when the drive was over. He washed her twice a week and Simonized her twice a year. He serviced her himself, buying time at a local garage. I wondered if it had been Darnell's. On that particular Sunday, they stopped at a roadside stand for hamburgers on the way home. There were no McDonald's in those days, you know, just roadside stands. And what happened was simple enough, I suppose. That silence again, as if he wondered just how much he should tell me, or how to separate what he knew from his speculations. "She choked to death on a piece of meat," he said finally. When she started to gag and put her hands to her throat, Raleigh pulled over, dragged her out of the car, and thudded her on the back, trying to bring it up. Of course, now they have a method, the Heimlich maneuver, that works rather well in situations like that. A young girl, a student teacher, actually saved a boy who was choking in the cafeteria at my school just last year by employing the Heimlich maneuver. But in those days, my niece died by the side of the road. I imagine it was a filthy, frightening way to die. His voice had resumed that sleepy schoolroom cadence, but I no longer felt sleepy, not at all. He tried to save her, I believe that. And I try to believe that it was only ill luck that she died. He had been in a ruthless business for a long time, and I don't believe he loved his daughter very deeply, if at all, but sometimes in mortal matters, a lack of love can be a saving grace. Sometimes ruthlessness is what is required. "But not this time," I said. In the end, he turned her over and held her by her ankles. He punched her in the belly, hoping to make her vomit. I believe he would have tried to do a tracheotomy on her with his pocket knife if he had even the slightest idea of how to go about it. But, of course, he did not. She died. Marcia and her husband and family came to the funeral. So did I. It was our last family reunion. I remember thinking he will have traded the car, of course. In an odd way, I was a little disappointed. It had figured so largely in Veronica's letters, and the few which Raleigh wrote, that I felt it was almost a member of their family. But he hadn't. They pulled up to the Libertyville Methodist Church in it, and it was polished, and shining, and hateful. It was hateful. He turned to look at me. "Do you believe that, Dennis?" I had to swallow before I could answer. "Yes," I said. "I believe it." Libbé nodded grimly. Veronica was sitting in the passenger seat like a wax dummy. Whatever she had been, whatever there was inside her, was gone. Raleigh had had the car. She had had the daughter. She didn't just grieve. She died. I sat there and tried to imagine it. Tried to imagine what I would have done if it had been me. My daughter starts to choke and strangle in the back seat of my car and then dies by the side of the road. Would I trade the car away? Why? It wasn't the car that killed her. It was whatever she strangled on, the bit of hamburger and bun that had blocked her windpipe. So why trade the car? Other than the small fact that I wouldn't even be able to look at it, wouldn't even be able to think of it without horror and sorrow, would I trade it manned as a bear shit in the woods? Did you ask him about it? I asked him, all right.
Marcia was with me. It was after the service. Veronica's brother had come up from Glory, West Virginia, and he took her back to the house after the graveside ceremony. She was in a kind of walking swoon anyway. We got him alone, Marcia and I. That was the real reunion. I asked him if he intended to trade the car. It was parked directly behind the hearse that had brought his daughter to the cemetery. The same cemetery where Raleigh himself was buried today, you know. It was red and white. Chrysler never offered the 1958 Plymouth Fury in those colors. Raleigh had gotten it custom painted. We were standing about 50 feet away from it, and I had the strangest feeling, the strangest urge, to move yet farther away as if it could hear us. What did you say? I asked him if he was going to trade the car. That hard, mulish look came onto his face, that look I remember so well from my early childhood. It was the look that had been on his face when he threw me under the picket fence. The look that was on his face when he kept calling my father a tosspot, even after my father made his nose bleed. He said, "I'd be crazy to trade her. George, she's only a year old, and she's only got 11,000 miles on her. You know, you never get your money out of a trade until a car's 3 years old." I said, "If this is a matter of money to you, Raleigh, someone stole what was left of your heart and replaced it with a piece of stone. Do you want your wife looking at it every day, riding in it? Good God, man." And that look never changed. Not until he looked at the car, sitting there in the sunlight, sitting there behind the hearse. That was the only time his face softened. I remember wondering if he'd ever looked at Rita that way. I don't suppose he ever did. I don't think it was in him. He fell silent for a moment and then went on. Marcia told him all the same things. She was always afraid of Raleigh, but that day she was more mad than afraid. She had gotten Veronica's letters, remember, and she knew how much Veronica loved her little girl. She told him that when someone dies, you burn the mattress they slept on, you give their clothes to the Salvation Army, whatever, you put finish to the life any way you can so that the living can get on with their business. She told him that his wife was never going to be able to get on with her business as long as the car where her daughter died was still in the garage. Raleigh asked her, in that ugly, sarcastic way he had, if she wanted him to douse his car with gasoline and touch a match to her just because his daughter had choked to death. My sister started to cry and told him she thought that was a fine idea. Finally, I took her by the arm and led her away. There was no talking to Raleigh then or ever. The car was his, and he could talk on and on about keeping a car 3 years before you trade it. He could talk about mileage until he was blue in the face, but the simple fact was he was going to keep her because he wanted to keep her. Marcia and her family went back to Denver on a Greyhound, and so far as I know, she never saw Raleigh again or even wrote him a note. She didn't come to Veronica's funeral. His wife. First the kid, and then the wife. I knew somehow that it had been just like that. Bang, bang. A kind of numbness crept up my legs to the pit of my stomach. She died 6 months later, in January of 1959. "But nothing to do with the car," I said. "Nothing to do with the car, right?" "It had everything to do with the car," he said softly. "I don't want to hear it," I thought. But of course I would hear it, because my friend owned that car now, and because it had become something that had grown out of all proportion to what it should have been in his life. After Rita died, Veronica went into a depression. She simply never came out of it. She had made some friends in Libertyville, and they tried to help her find her way again, I guess one would say. But she was not able to find her way, not at all. Otherwise, things were fine. For the first time in my brother's life, there was plenty of money. He had his army pension, his disability pension, and he had gotten a job as a night watchman at the tire factory over on the west side of town. I drove over there after the funeral, but it's gone. "It went broke 12 years ago," I said. "I was just a kid. There's a Chinese fast food place there now."
They were paying off the mortgage at the rate of 2 payments a month, and, of course, they had no little girl to take care of any longer. But for Veronica, there was never any light or impulse toward recovery. She went about committing suicide quite cold-bloodedly, from all that I have been able to find out. If there were textbooks for aspiring suicides, her own might be included as an example to emulate. She went down to the Western Auto Store here in town, the same one where I got my first bicycle many, many years ago, and bought 20 feet of rubber hose. She fitted one end over Christine's exhaust pipe and put the other end in one of the back windows. She had never gotten a driver's license, but she knew how to start the car. That was really all she needed to know. I pursed my lips, wet them with my tongue, and heard my voice little more than a rusty croak. "I think I'll get that soda now." "Perhaps you'd be good enough to get me another," he said. "It will keep me awake. They always do. But I suspect I'd be awake most of tonight anyway." I suspected I would be, too. I went to get the sodas in the motel office, and on my way back I stopped halfway across the parking lot. He was only a deeper shadow in front of his motel unit, his white socks glimmering like small ghosts. I thought, maybe the car is cursed. Maybe that's what it is. It sounds like a ghost story, all right. "There's a signpost up ahead. Next up, the Twilight Zone." But that was ridiculous, wasn't it? Of course it was. I went on walking again. Cars didn't carry curses any more than people carried them. That was horror movie stuff, sort of amusing for a Saturday night at the drive-in, but very, very far from the day-to-day facts that make up reality. I gave him his can of soda and heard the rest of his story, which could be summed up in one line. He lived unhappily ever after. The one and only Roland D. LeBay had kept his small tract house, and he had kept his 1958 Plymouth. In 1965, he had hung up his night watchman's cap and his check-in clock. And somewhere around that same time, he had stopped his painstaking efforts to keep Christine looking and running like new. He had let her run down the way a man might let a watch run down. "You mean it just sat out there?" I asked. "Since 1965? For 13 years?" "No, he put it in the garage, of course," LeBay said. "The neighbors would never have stood for a car just moldering away out on someone's lawn. In the country, maybe, but not in suburbia, USA." "But it was out there when we..." "Yes, I know. He put it out on the lawn with a for sale sign in the window. I asked about that. I was curious, and so I asked at the Legion. Most of them had lost touch with Raleigh, but one of them said he thought he'd seen the car out there on the lawn for the first time this May." I started to say something, and then fell silent. A terrible idea had come to me, and that idea was simply this. It was too convenient. Much too convenient. Christine had sat in that dark garage for years, 4, 8, a dozen more. Then, a few months before Arnie and I came along and Arnie saw it, Roland LeBay had suddenly hauled it out and stuck a for sale sign on it. Later on, much later, I checked back through issues of the Pittsburgh papers and the Libertyville paper, the Keystone. He had never advertised the Fury, at least not in the papers, where you usually hawk a car you want to sell. He just put it out on his suburban street, not even a thoroughfare, and waited for a buyer to come along. I did not completely realize the rest of the thought then, not in any logical, intellectual way at least, but I had enough of it to feel a recurrence of that cold, blue feeling of fright. It was as if he knew a buyer would be coming, if not in May, then in June, or July, or August, sometime soon. No, I didn't get this idea logically or rationally. What came instead was a wholly visceral image. A Venus flytrap at the edge of a swamp, its green jaws wide open, waiting for an insect to land. The right insect. I remember thinking he must have given it up because he didn't want to take a chance of flunking the driver's exam, I said finally. After you get so old they make you take one every year or two, the renewal stops being automatic. George LeBay nodded. "That sounds like Raleigh," he said. But what? I remember reading somewhere, and I can't remember who said it or wrote it for the life of me, that there are times in human existence that when it came to be steam engine time, a dozen men invented steam engines. Maybe only one man got the patent or the credit in the history books, but all at once there they were, all those people working on that one idea. How do you explain it? Just that it's steam engine time. LeBay took a drink of his soda and looked up at the sky. Comes the Civil War, and all at once it's ironclad time. Then it's machine gun time. Next thing you know, it's electricity time, and wireless time, and finally it's atom bomb time. As if those ideas all come not from individuals, but from some great wave of intelligence that always keeps flowing. Some wave of intelligence that is outside of humanity. He looked at me. That idea scares me if I think about it too much, Dennis. There seems to be something, well, decidedly unchristian about it. And for your brother, there was Sel Christine time? Perhaps. Ecclesiastes says, there's a season for everything, a time to sow, a time to reap, a time for war, a time for peace, a time to put away the sling, and a time to gather stones together, a negative for every positive. So if there was Christine time in Raleigh's life, there might have come a time for him to put Christine away as well. If so, he would have known it. He was an animal, and animals listen very well to their instincts. Or maybe he finally just tired of it. LeBay finished. I nodded that that might be it, mostly because I was anxious to be gone, not because that explained it to my complete satisfaction. George LeBay hadn't seen that car on the day Arnie had yelled at me to go back. I had seen it, though. The 58 hadn't looked like a car that had been resting peacefully in a garage. It had been dirty and dented, the windshield cracked, one bumper mostly torn away. It had looked like a corpse that had been disinterred and left to decay in the sun. I thought of Veronica LeBay and shivered. As if reading my thoughts, part of them anyway, LeBay said, I know very little about how my brother may have lived or felt during the last years of his life. But I'm quite sure of one thing, Dennis. When he felt, in 1965, or whenever it was, that it was time to put the car away, he put it away. And when he felt it was time to put it up for sale, he put it up for sale. He paused. And I don't think I have anything else to tell you, except that I really believe your friend would be happier if he got rid of that car. I looked at him closely, your friend. He didn't look like a particularly happy young man at the present. Am I wrong about that? I considered his question carefully. No, happiness wasn't exactly Arnie's thing and never had been. But until the thing had begun with the Plymouth, he had seemed at least content, as if he had reached a modus vivendi with life. Not a completely happy one, but at least a workable one. No, I said, you're not wrong. I don't believe my brother's car will make him happy. If anything, just the opposite. And as if he had read my thoughts of a few minutes before, he went on, I don't believe in curses, you know, nor in ghosts or anything precisely supernatural, but I do believe that emotions and events have a certain lingering resonance. It may be that emotions can even communicate themselves in certain circumstances, if the circumstances are peculiar enough. The way a carton of milk will take the flavor of certain strongly spiced foods if it's left open in the refrigerator. Or perhaps that's only a ridiculous fancy on my part. Possibly it's just that I would feel better knowing the car my niece choked in and my sister-in-law killed herself in had been pressed down into a cube of meaningless metal. Perhaps all I feel is a sense of outraged propriety. Mr. LeBay, you said you'd hired someone to take care of your brother's house until it was sold. Was that true? He shifted a little in his chair.
No, it wasn't. I lied on impulse. I didn't like the thought of that car back in that garage, as if it had found its way home. If there are emotions and feelings that still live on, they would be there, as well as in the car herself. And very quickly, he corrected himself, itself. Not long after, I said my goodbyes and followed my headlights home through the dark, thinking over everything Libea told me. I wondered if it would make any difference to Arnie if I told him one person had had a mortal accident in his car and another had actually died in it. I pretty well knew that it wouldn't. In his own way, Arnie could be every bit as stubborn as Roland Libea himself. The lovely little scene over the car with his parents had shown that quite conclusively. The fact that he went on taking auto shop courses down there in the Libertyville High version of the DMZ showed the same thing. I thought of Libea saying, "I didn't like the thought of that car back in that garage, as if it had found its way home." He had also said that his brother took the car someplace to work on it, and the only do-it-yourself garage in Libertyville now was Will Darnell's. Of course, there might have been another back in the 50s, but I didn't believe it. In my heart, what I believed was that Arnie had been working on Christine in a place where she had been worked on before. Had been. That was the operant phrase. Because of the fight with Buddy Repperton, Arnie was afraid to leave it there any longer. So maybe that avenue to Christine's past was blocked off as well. And, of course, there were no curses. Even LeBay's idea about lingering emotions was pretty far-fetched. I doubted if he really believed it himself. He had shown me an old scar, and he had used the word vengeance, and that was probably a lot closer to the truth than any phony supernatural bullshit, of course. No, I was 17 years old, bound for college in another year, and I didn't believe in such things as curses and emotions that linger and grow rancid, the spilled milk of dreams. I would not have granted you the power of the past to reach out horrid dead hands toward the living. But I'm a little older now. 13. Later that evening. As I was motivating over the hill, I saw Maybelline in a Coupe de Ville, Cadillac rolling down the open road, but nothing outrun my V8 Ford. Chuck Berry. My mother and Elaine had gone to bed, but my dad was up watching the 11 o'clock news on TV. "Where you been, Dennis?" he asked. "Bowling," I said, the lie coming naturally and instinctively to my lips. I didn't want my father to know any of this. Peculiar as it was, it really wasn't peculiar enough to be more than moderately interesting, or so I rationalized. "Arnie called," he said. "Asked me to have you call back if you got in before 11:30 or so." I glanced at my watch. It was only 11:20. But hadn't I had enough of Arnie and Arnie's problems for one day? "Well?" "Well, what?" "Are you going to call him?" I sighed. "Yeah, I guess I will." I went into the kitchen, slapped together a cold chicken sandwich, poured myself a glass of Hawaiian punch, gross stuff, but I love it, and dialed Arnie's house. He picked up the phone himself on the second ring. He sounded happy and excited. "Dennis, where you been?" "Bowling," I said. "Listen, I went down to Darnell's tonight, you know? And this is great, Dennis. He gave Repperton the boot. Repperton's gone, and I can stay." That sensation of unformed dread in my belly again. I put my sandwich down. Suddenly I didn't want it anymore. "Arnie, do you think taking it back there is really such a good idea?" "What do you mean? Repperton's gone. That doesn't sound like a good idea to you." I thought about Darnell ordering Arnie to turn off his car before it polluted his cruddy garage. Darnell telling Arnie he didn't take any shit from kids like him. I thought about the shame-faced way Arnie had cut his eyes away from mine when he told me he had gotten lift time to change his oil by doing a couple of errands. I had an idea that Darnell might find it amusing to turn Arnie into his pet gopher. It would amuse the shit out of his other regulars and his poker buddies. Arnie goes out for coffee. Arnie goes out for donuts. Arnie changes the toilet paper rolls in the crapper and loads up the Nybrock dispenser with paper towels. "Hey, Will, who's the four-eyes swapping out the toilet in there?" "Him? Name's Cunningham. His folks teach up at the college. He's taking a shithouse post-grad course down here." And they would laugh. Arnie would become the local joke down at Darnell's garage on Hampton Street. I thought about those things, but I didn't say them.
I figured Arnie could make up his own mind about whether he was treading water or shit. This couldn't go on forever. Arnie was just too smart, or so I hoped. He was ugly, but he wasn't dumb. Repperton being gone sounds like a fine idea, I said. It was just that I thought Darnell's was sort of a temporary measure. I mean, 20 a week, Arnie, that's pretty stiff, on top of the tools fees and the lift fees and all that happy crappy. That's why I thought renting Mr. LeBay's garage would be so great, Arnie said. I figured that even at 25 a week, I'd be better off. Well, there you go. If you put an ad in the paper for garage space, I bet you'd... No, let me finish, Arnie said. He was still excited. When I went down there this afternoon, Darnell took me aside right away. Said he was sorry about the ragging I had to take from Repperton. He said he misjudged me. He said that? I guess I believed it, but I didn't trust it. Yeah, he asked me how I'd like to work for him part-time. 10, maybe 20 hours a week during school. Putting stuff away, lubing the lifts, that kind of thing. And I can have the space for 10 a week, tool fees and lift fees at half. How does that sound? I thought it sounded too fucking good to be true. Watch your ass, Arnie. What? My dad says he's a crook. I haven't seen any sign of it. I think that's all just talk, Dennis. He's a loudmouth, but I think that's all. I'm just telling you to stay loose, that's all. I switched the phone to my other ear and drank some Hawaiian punch. Keep your eyes open and move away quick if anything starts to look heady. Are you talking about anything specific? I thought of the vague stories about drugs, the more specific ones about hot cars. No, I said. I just don't trust him. Well, he said doubtfully, trailing away, and then came back to the original subject, Christine. With him, it always got back to Christine. But it's a break, a real break for me, Dennis, if it works out. Christine, she's really hurting. I've been able to do some things with her, but for everything I do, it looks like there's four more. Some of it I don't even know how to do, but I'm going to learn. Yeah, I said, and took a bite out of my sandwich. After my conversation with George LeBay, my enthusiasm for the subject of Arnie's best girl, Christine, had passed zero and entered the negative regions. She needs a front-end alignment. Hell, she needs a new front end. And new brake shoes, a ring job. I may try to re-grind the pistons, but I can't do any of that stuff with my 54-buck Craftsman toolkit. You see what I mean, Dennis? He sounded like he was pleading for my approval. With a sinking in my stomach, I suddenly remembered a guy we had gone to school with. Freddy Darlington, his name had been. Freddy was no ball of fire, but he was an okay kid with a good sense of humor. Then he met some slut from Penn Hills, and I mean a real slut, one more than happy to stoop for the troops, bang for the gang, pick your pejorative. She had a mean, stupid face that reminded me of the back end of a Mack truck, and she never stopped chewing gum. The stink of juicy fruit hung around her in a constant cloud. She got pregnant at about the same time Freddy got hung up on her. I always sort of figured he got hung up on her because she was the first girl to let him go all the way. So what happens is he drops out of school, gets a job in a warehouse, the princess has the baby, and he shows up with her at a party after the junior prom last December, wanting everything to seem the same when nothing is the same. She is looking at all of us guys with those dead, contemptuous eyes. Her jaws are going up and down like the jaws of a cow working over a particularly tasty cud. And all of us have heard the news. She's back at the bowling alley. She's back at the Libertyville wreck. She's back at Gino's. She's out cruising while Freddy is working. She's back hard at work, banging for the gang and stooping for the troops. I know they say that a stiff dick has no conscience. But I tell you now that some cunts have teeth, and when I looked at Freddy looking 10 years older than he should have, I felt like I wanted to cry. And when he talked about her, he did it in that same pleading tone I had heard in Arnie's voice just now. You really like her, guys, don't you? She's all right, isn't she, guys? I didn't fuck up too bad, did I, guys? I mean, this is probably just a bad dream, and I'll wake up pretty soon, right? 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 Sure, I said into the telephone. That whole stupid, ugly Freddy Darlington business had gone through my mind in maybe 2 seconds. I see what you mean, Arnie. Good, he said, relieved. Just watch out for your ass. And that goes double when you get back to school. Keep away from Buddy Repperton. Yeah, you bet. Arnie. What? I paused.
I wanted to ask him if Darnell had said anything about Christine being in his shop before, if he had recognized her. Even more, I wanted to tell him what had happened to Mrs. LeBay and to her small daughter, Rita. But I couldn't. He would know right away where I had gotten the information. And in his touchy state over the damn car, he would be apt to think I had gone behind his back. And, in a way, I had. But to tell him I had might well mean the end of our friendship. I had had enough of Christine, but I still cared for Arnie, which meant that door had to be closed for good. No more creeping around and asking questions. No more lectures. "Nothing," I said. "I was just going to say that I guess you found a home for your rust bucket. Congratulations."
"Dennis, are you eating something?"
"Yeah, chicken sandwich. Why?"
"You're chewing in my ear. It really sounds gross."
I began to smack as loudly as I could. Arnie made puking sounds. We both got laughing, and it was good. It was like the old days before he married that numb fucking car.
"You're an asshole, Dennis."
"That's right, I learned it from you."
"Get bent," he said, and hung up.
I finished my sandwich and my Hawaiian punch, rinsed the plate and the glass, and went back into the living room, ready to shower and go to bed. I was beat. Sometime during the phone conversation, I had heard the TV go off and had assumed that my father had gone upstairs. But he hadn't. He was sitting in his recliner chair with his shirt open. I noticed with some unease how gray the hair on his chest was getting, and the way the reading lamp beside him shone through the hair on his head and showed his pink scalp getting thinner up there. My father was no kid. I realized with greater unease that in 5 years, by the time I would theoretically finish college, he would be 50 and balding, a stereotype accountant. 50 in 5 years, if he didn't just drop dead of another heart attack. The first one had not been bad, no myocardial scarring, he had told me on the one occasion I had asked. But he did not try to tell me that a second heart attack wasn't likely. I knew it was, my mom knew it was, and he did too. Only Ellie still thought he was invulnerable. But hadn't I seen a question in her eyes once or twice? I thought maybe I had. Died suddenly. I felt the hairs on my scalp stir. Suddenly. Straightening up at his desk, clutching his chest. Suddenly. Dropping his racket on the tennis court. You didn't want to think those thoughts about your father, but sometimes they come. God knows they do. I couldn't help overhearing some of that, he said. Yeah? Wearily. Has Arnie Cunningham got his foot in a bucket of something warm and brown, Dennis? I don't know for sure, I said slowly. Because after all, what did I have? Vapors, that was all. You want to talk about it? Not right now, Dad, if it's okay. It's fine, he said. But if it, as you said on the phone, if it gets heavy, will you for God's sake tell me what's happening? Yes. Okay. I started for the stairs and was almost there when he stopped me by saying, I ran Will Darnell's accounts and did his income tax returns for almost 15 years, you know. I turned back to him, really surprised. No, I didn't know that. My father smiled. It was a smile I had never seen before, one I would guess my mother had seen only a few times, my sis maybe not at all. You might have thought it was a sleepy sort of smile at first, but if you looked more closely, you would have seen that it was not sleepy at all. It was cynical and hard and totally aware. Can you keep your mouth shut about something, Dennis? Yes, I said, I think so. Don't just think so. Yes, I can. Better. I did his figures up until 1975, and then he got Bill Upshaw over in Monroeville. My father looked at me closely. I won't say that Bill Upshaw is a crook, but I will say that his scruples are thin enough to read a newspaper through. And last year he bought himself a $300,000 English tutor in Sewickley. Damn the interest rates, full speed ahead. He gestured at our own home with a small sweep of his right arm, and then let it drop back into his own lap. He and my mother had bought it the year before I was born for $62,000. It was now worth maybe $150,000. And they had only recently gotten their paper back from the bank. We had a little party in the backyard late last summer. Dad lit the barbecue, put the pink slip on the long fork, and each of us got a chance at holding it over the coals until it was gone.
No English tutor here, Aunt Annie, he said.
It's fine,
I said. I came back and sat down on the couch. Darnell and I parted amicably enough, my father went on. Not that I ever cared very much for him in a personal way. I thought he was a wretch. I nodded a little because I liked that. It expressed my gut feelings about Will Darnell better than any profanity could. But there's all the difference in the world between a personal relationship and a business relationship. You learn that very quickly in this business, or you give it up and start selling Fuller brushes door to door. Our business relationship was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. That was why I finally called it quits. I don't get you. Cash kept showing up, he said. Large amounts of cash with no clear ancestry. At Darnell's direction, I invested in two corporations, Pennsylvania Solar Heating and New York Ticketing, that sounded like two of the dummiest dummy corporations I've ever heard of. Finally, I went to see him because I wanted all my cards on the table. I told him that my professional opinion was that if he got audited either by the IRS or by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania tax boards, he was apt to have a great deal of explaining to do, and that before long I was going to know too much to be an asset to him. What did he say? He began to dance, my father said, still wearing that sleepy, cynical smile. In my business, you start to get familiar with the steps of the dance by the time you're 38 or so, if you're good at your business, that is. And I'm not all that bad. The dance starts off with the guy asking you if you're happy with your work, if it's paying you enough. If you say you like the work, but you sure could be doing better, the guy encourages you to talk about whatever you're carrying on your back, your house, your car, your kids' college education. Maybe you've got a wife with a taste for clothes a little fancier than she can by rights afford, see? Sounding you out? It's more like feeling you up, he said, and then laughed. But yeah, the dance is every bit as mannered as a minuet. There are all sorts of phrases and pauses and steps. After the guy finds out what sort of financial burdens you'd like to get rid of, he starts asking you what sort of things you'd like to have. A Cadillac, a summer place in the Catskills or the Poconos, maybe a boat. End of side 3. To continue, turn the cassette over.